Hi, everybody, and a warm welcome from Germany. It's logistics time again, and thank you very much for joining this episode of The Joy of Logistics again. Today, we are going to continue our AMH, or American Maritime Highway Podcast mini-series or special series. Today's guest is Walter Kemsies, and at this point I gotta apologize for like last week short notice postponement, but yeah, as you guys know, or if you've been dealing and working in logistics for quite some time, you know there's one big constant, which is change. And of course, obviously, on last minute things pop up that we gotta solve, so we postponed it, but nevertheless, we are still doing it, obviously, because with Walter, we have a really heavy hitter, and we are going to cover a lot of interesting questions and share a lot of tremendous information that will impact your decisions and will also hopefully be some food for thought. So, just in case that you are joining us the first time today and you don't know who I am, let me introduce myself. My name is Christoph. I'm your host. I'm the host of The Joy Logistics. I'm also posting frequently about all sorts of logistics development on LinkedIn under the hashtag Planet Logistics. If you're wondering why am I qualified to talk about all that stuff, I hold a bachelor's degree in logistics, and I'm working roughly a decade now in logistics. I've seen both sides of the table, meaning I am working for a freight forwarder, but I've also been sitting on the BCO side, mapping everything out, organizing all of that, doing the negotiations. Yeah, so that's why I'm qualified and why I also love host The Joy of Logistics, because I really believe logistics is not meant to be difficult, or it's not meant to be frustrating at any sort. No, in fact, it should be helping in our daily business, especially for the BCOs. And for the cargo owners, it should be an ease. Hence, I created Joy Logistics together with Jose, because I really want to point out of the box solutions. I really want to share information that lead to thinking and get the ball rolling. So coming back to the AMH mini series today with Walter, after having Brad Rems on the other day, who really shared some amazing information and shed light upon very interesting things. And I'm confident that we're going to continue this today. Today's guest, Mr. Walter Kemsies. He's the CEO of the Kemsies Group. I also learned that he's also a fellow podcaster. I'm looking forward to having him on. So let me see. We're going to cover a lot of interesting questions. And without further ado, Walter, there we are. Thank you so much for taking your time and for being on the show. Appreciate it.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Walter, I guess a lot of folks in the audience have some question marks because they don't know you. Would you help them out and introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, sure. I was born in the U.S., but I grew up in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. And I came back to go to school, and I liked the university so much, I stayed until I earned a PhD. And then I went off to teach school for a while, but I ended up leaving and joining the finance industry. And the company that I joined, I got bought by Swiss Bank Corporation, Bank Verein, as they called it then. And I got moved to Zurich. After a few years, I got moved to London, and I was there about 10 years. And And then I came back to the U.S. I had met, when I came back, a guy called Dr. John Rickles. Dr. Rickles was Malcolm McLean's chief economist for over 20 years. John was working on a project involved finance. And since I was from the finance industry, he asked me to moonlight a little bit and help out. So I did. And we got along very well. And next thing you know, he was trying to hire me into a really good marine engineering company. Eventually, I said no, I didn't. The salary was too low, but eventually I gave in. It was a good place to work, and John was interesting. And less than a year later, Wall Street collapsed. So I would have lost my job. And thanks to Dr. Rickles, I had a really great job. So I've worked with ports all over the U.S., Canada, Mexico, in South America, a little bit in Europe. Most of the time what I get involved in is capital improvement planning. You know, so how do you grow and develop a port? But I've worked with port authorities, ocean carriers, railroads, trucking companies, distribution center operators and investors. So a wide variety of things. And the way I think of it is I work for gateways, because when you look at a port, a good port knows that what's happening with the port has to do with all of the elements of the gateway. So you need waterways that are deep enough and clear enough so that the ships can come. You need the highways with sufficient capacity to avoid congestion, especially during peak times. You need the rail capacity. You need the port itself, but you also need to have places to put things that are not in the port, because the port needs to be kept free. And that's why the industrial real estate community is part of the gateway. And these days, because population growth in the U.S. is slowing to a halt, so the labor force is not getting bigger, it is necessary to include having labor force in your gateway planning. So how are you going to get more workers? How are you going to train them? It's becoming quite a battle in the U.S., but again, it's part of the gateway. So I've been privileged to have worked with some ports for a long time, like the Georgia Port Authority for 16 years. And it's a terrific place. I learned a lot about the gateway with them, because that's where I started. But I'll stop here. I think it's enough background on me.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, one can clearly say you're a heavy hitter. You've been in the logistics industry for quite some time. And wow, amazing, considering all these stops that you had, not just from a geographical point of view, but also, yeah, if you've been working with gateways in, you know, whether it's a terminal provider, carrier, port authority itself, that's pretty terrific. It's very impressive. Just as a side note, Northern Europe, we are facing the same challenges when it comes down to demographics, population growth, is shrinking all the time. Birth rates are, I believe, somewhere in between 0.6 to 0.8. So, not that bright of a future. And exactly what you mentioned, it's really a challenge to make sure that you maintain the labor force. We also see similar developments when it comes down to truckers, for instance, just as you guys do in the US. And it's the so-called war for talent. And I think this doesn't stop in the logistics industry either, right?
No, but some industries don't have the same problem we do. Like if you go to media, finance, technology, they can get young, smart people, quote unquote smart, to go work for nothing. For half a banana, in the hopes that they will become owners of this thing, or it'll become a very successful enterprise. But our industry just lacks sex appeal.
Yes.
Nobody ever told their kid, when you grow up, I want you to be a truck driver, right?
Correct. You know, yeah.
So we have to plan. I raised this issue with the ports here in the U.S. back in 2016, because when you do long-range port development planning, you need long-range forecasts, and you build your forecast always off demographics. You know, it's the least inaccurate forward-looking number that you have to work with, and quite quite honestly, the economy is just a whole bunch of people making things. So the more people you have, the more things get made, the bigger is GDP. And so, you know, we have to pay close attention to that. And even on the demand side for things, I mean, it's not the old people who are buying stuff. Old people have sales. It's the younger people who go to the sales to buy things. You know, they have the children, they have, you know, the house to build, the family. So, and the older folks, they're like, you know, fading away, getting rid of their stuff if they can. I'm more in that department these days.
Yeah, but that's a good point that you're making. And in fact, yeah, just catching up also with the gateway part that you mentioned in your introduction, it's number one, you got to make sure, obviously, the canal or the river or even the bayside is deep enough, especially these days when the vessels are getting bigger and bigger and larger and deeper. You got to make sure that those are handled. Same holds true also with the terminal itself, respectively, with the connections, not just on the trucking side, but also on the railroad side, which has been, a needle hole, so to speak, throughout the pandemic, because so much cargo was pouring in and trains were put on idle tracks because port connection, but also inland rail depots have been overwhelmed based on what I've seen and what I've heard. Last week, what I read, if we take a look onto the Mississippi, with the river levels continuing to drop, it's getting more and more difficult and riskier to ship the cargo throughout the Mississippi, respectively, the connecting rivers. What's your thought on the Mississippi water level drop? I'll put it like this.
Yeah, well, it's not a unique thing to the U.S. I mean, you know, the Elbe also dropped a lot. The Danube, in China, you know, all the major rivers also dropped a lot. I mean, there were shocking pictures in the media of water levels 30 or more feet, 10 or more meters, right, below normal levels. People were getting chased away from the riverbanks in China, because it was very hot and they would go there to wade and, you know, try to swim a little bit. So it's a global phenomena. And if you look back to last year in the southern half of the hemisphere, during the northern hemisphere's winter, the southern hemisphere also had that problem. In Brazil, the Paraná River, which, you know, runs between Paraguay and Argentina, you know, Uruguay, etc. The Paraná, in the native language, I think it's the Tupi natives, Paraná means like the sea. And when you stand on the border on one side of the Paraná River, you cannot see the other side of the river. That's how broad it is. And so it dropped, you know, terribly. I think it dropped to like 50% of its normal level last year in the summer. And it was a historical low. And there were other issues with rivers in other parts of the southern hemisphere. So there's something very wrong with the balance of water going into the air and coming back out. And what's scary about the Mississippi River is the Weather Forecasting Service is saying that it's not going to be a very snowy winter. And that's a problem, because you need the snow for the ice melt to feed the rivers. Usually in the spring, you're fighting the Mississippi flooding places. So you have floodgates down in Louisiana and other places where you open it up to let the water flow out quickly. And this year, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't going to try to dam up the river and try to maintain the level. But coincidentally, I lived in Memphis for 7 years, and the area where they're struggling the most is right near Memphis. And I recognize all the pictures, and it really is a very worrisome thing.
I mean, if we now bridged over to logistics, based on my knowledge, I got as a European, it's limited on that. But based on my knowledge, especially Mississippi is used for a lot of bulk shipments, right?
Yes.
So, this then would heavily impact the cargo flow, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Mississippi is a critical, passage from the upper Midwest, where a lot of soy is grown, corn, wheat, and all of that gets put in barges. They go down the river until they get to New Orleans or a little bit north. And these products are sometimes put in containers. Archer Daniel Midland has a facility in New Orleans. So the barges, can come down there, and they get a lot of their product gets put into big sacks and rolled into containers. It all depends on the kind of product and what it's being used for. For example, if you have genetically modified grains and oil seeds, those have to be containerized because they cannot be replanted. You don't own the copyright to that. Syngenta and the other guys get pretty angry if you replant them. So it is a practice to put these things in containers to avoid, contamination. Also, up north in North Dakota, where, a long time ago the glaciers came through, the land is very, black and rich. The temperature is barely long enough to grow one crop a year. And so you don't have very many pests. You don't have fungus. There's just not enough time for all of that. And you don't have to put fertilizer in the ground because it is such rich soil. And that soy does not go down the river. That one gets bagged at the farm. A friend of mine, Bob Sinner, has his farm, and he bags it, on his farm for identity preservation. It means geographical identity preservation. And that goes into, gets rolled into containers, and those containers go via Seattle over to Japan and Korea. And his product is so good that he gets paid a multiple of what the Chicago Mercantile Exchange futures prices are. It's when you get to Japan, in the supermarkets, they have little scanners on the wall, and you take the bag up to the scanner and read it, and it'll tell you the geographical identity of the product. Consumers can be that finicky about a product like that. Whereas in Brazil, that produces soy as well, the problem there is a lot of it is grown in this red clay kind of dirt. And when you make products out of it, like soy milk or natto, they don't come out white. They come out a little pink. And it's been described to me as that's like, it looks like milk with a drop of blood in it. And it's like, oh, that's terrible. So the other stuff all goes bulk, but at some point, either for a legal reason or because of a product value reason, you would see the product go by container. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to jump on this real quick, Walter. Most of the time, those containers, let's just take for example your friend Bob. Bob's containers most likely will at one point get on the rail. To be hauled over to Seattle or Vancouver.
That's right. They have to be. He goes into Minneapolis, which is the closest rail route, and he has a driver dray it over to his farm. He loads it up, and then he drays it back, and it gets on the rail ramp in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. If we just assume that the river levels, the Mississippi, etc., would be more or less equal and would be shippable, do you think it would be a benefit to Bob or to other farmers up there if they would ship the containers with a barge to whether that's Mobile, Alabama, or whether that's a different port? Do you think that this would be helpful for them, also from an economic point of view?
No, not really, because if you look at the map where they're based, it's a straight run to Seattle along the southern border, and then onto a ship in Seattle or Tacoma, and from there it's a straight shot over to Japan and Korea. So that would be the shortest distance. Whereas if you send it the barge down the river to say New Orleans, or even Mobile, the problem is you have a longer ocean voyage. But mm-hmm. my understanding is the way the barge gets priced for its run is off what the rail cost and the shipping costs would be out of Seattle. And the way the rail is priced is based off what the barge is charging. So you're right in assuming that some of it could go down the river. And if it was cheap enough, they might consider doing that. Right now on the Mississippi, the only containers that I see on the river are empty containers from Memphis, Tennessee, being barged down to New Orleans, which is how Archer Daniel Midland gets containers for it to fill with all of the soy that comes down the river in bulk form, as well as other grains.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We should be looking at
Mobile. Oh yeah. No. I can follow you. I mean, Mobile, Alabama. It's a very interesting port. In actuality, I've read the other day. Well, not just that, it's continuing to raise the bar for record container handling month by month, but it's also strategically pretty well located. I mean, it's not as crowded as Houston, Texas, for instance. Yeah. And it has perfect connections, not just to Europe, but also especially down to Asia and or South America, if required, right?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the port. I've worked for that port on and off for the last 16 years. Currently, I have some projects in Mobile, but they're not related to the port directly. But I do know the port executives. They're good friends of mine. I worked for them when they were running the Port of Oakland. So the previous director retired in 2020, Jimmy Lyons. Fantastic guy. And I said something at some meeting, and next thing you know, the two came over from Oakland. So they're top-notch executives. And you're right, the port is in a good location to serve the Midwest, primarily by rail. But you do have a water. The Mobile River connects to the 10-Tom Bigbee Waterway, which then connects into all of the core rivers that are part of the Mississippi River system. So you could really do things out of either port to go north. But most of what happens is basically rail. That's the aside.
If we take a look on the AMH as such, meaning the American Maritime Highway, just for the audience, do you think also for containerized goods on a broader scale, on a great scale, do you think that this would be cost efficient or let's say cost effective?
For international containers that are 40 foot, I don't think so. But if you were thinking 53 foot domestic containers, I think it could work. So for full disclosure, I work with a group of people who started a container on barge business back in August of 2020. It was the M10 Marine Highway. And so there was a interstate system in the U.S. So the one that runs from Jacksonville, Florida, through Texas, all the way to Los Angeles, that's called I-10. And so, and you have I-95, which runs roughly from Boston down to Miami. So we have M-95 for Marine Highway 95 that goes along the East Coast, and you have M-10. And so we operated on the M10 from Brownsville to Tampa. There is no real rail service coming out of Mexico going all the way around and into Florida. There are rail roads that connect, but it's long and it's expensive. And there's a lot of trucking. There's a lot of congestion. And everybody goes through Laredo. Well, because then you get on I-35, and that's the NAFTA corridor, right, or the USMCA corridor, whatever silly name we now call the trade agreement. We ran one from Brownsville, Texas, to Tampa, Florida. And basically the Mexican truck drivers could literally drive into the port in Brownsville because they're allowed to drive 50 miles into the U.S., without any issue.
Okay.
And so we had 53 foot containers, and they would go, they would get drayed over to the factories in places like Monterrey, and get loaded up and then come to Brownsville. We pack them in a barge, and then we sail the barge across the Gulf over to Tampa. And unfortunately, it went bankrupt, not because there wasn't demand. There was plenty of demand. The problem is that the calculations that we made for how much equipment do we need were made before COVID. And what happened during COVID is the equipment cycle times were three times longer than we thought they would be. Because, you know, the truck shows up at the factory's struggling to make stuff because some of the workers are homesick, others didn't show. And so sometimes the factory isn't even open. So your equipment gets stuck there waiting to get filled up. Then it gets dragged over to the port. You load it with other barges, other containers on the barge, and it goes across and it gets out in Tampa. And then it gets straight over to the warehouse. And the problem is you get to the warehouse and there's nobody there to receive it. They're sick or they don't have enough people to work the warehouse. And so we started with something like 500 containers and you ended up, because of COVID, needing at least three times as many. So I am familiar with this. So if we had had, you know, if we had started with three times as many containers, we would not have looked very smart. So, essentially what happens is if you don't have enough containers, you can't generate enough revenue, you can't break even, et cetera. So but there is demand. There is a very successful container and barge service that runs from the port of Norfolk in Virginia up the James River to Richmond, Virginia. And I helped them get that started. We applied for what's called the CMAQ, a congestion mitigation air quality grant that funded the business for a couple of years until it stabilized and got on its feet. It's doing very well. I think it's now a daily service, and I think they're thinking of adding even more runs on the river. So, you know, container and barge can be profitable. It just depends on the instance. Like in Memphis, we have too many empties. The trains go from Los Angeles, Long Beach over to Memphis. There are a lot of distribution centers there, so you drop a lot of containers off, and then the train goes on to, say, Chicago. And then to get the empties, the train doesn't really want to stop for empties on the way from Chicago towards LA, right? That's not the valuable part of the run. And you have a chronic shortage of empties in the Gulf Coast, because the Gulf Coast, the head haul is exports. Whereas if you go to the East Coast or the West Coast, the head haul is imports. So what that means is there's a chronic deficit of equipment that needs to be filled. And that's why that container and barge service from Memphis is so important. In Richmond, it's just simply 100 miles from the port of Norfolk to the Richmond area. And Richmond, you know, putting a container on a barge is environmentally friendlier than putting it on a truck. I was looking some of this up, and basically, you know, you can put it, you can move 1 ton over 600 miles with 1 gallon of diesel. You cannot do that with the truck. You cannot even do that with the train. So,
crazy.
So you're putting far less fuel. Well, see, it's because water is slippery. You know, if you look at a road as asphalt, asphalt is not slippery unless you put water on it. You've got steel,
right,
which is a little smoother, a little less friction. And then when you get to water, it's perfect. It's, you know, it's how an engineering friend of mine explained it to me. It's cheaper to move stuff on the water because water is slippery. You know, and that kind of stuck with me. It's a good friend of mine, Larry Nye at Moffitt and Nichol. So when you think about that, I mean, the impact on the environment is far, far less if you can move things on a barge.
Mm-hmm. And just what you mentioned, the Richmond, Virginia service, I just want to pick up real quick on that. As far as I know, there are even some international container liners that offer, I think that's a better way here, that offered the connection from Norfolk with the barge up to Richmond, Virginia. I know, for instance, Hapag-Lloyd does it.
Mm-hmm.
They offer that amongst other. So, but I guess it boils down to what you mentioned earlier, Walter, is if there is enough demand somehow, where it also makes sense on a geographical way, because obviously No one is going to build up or set up a barge service just for 10 containers in a quarter, right? I guess it has to be a little bit more than that. Just wanted to point out here, if there is enough demand, this will be actually adopted, even just a fraction of the whole highway, but it will be adopted and offered by containerized steamship lines as well, or could be.
Oh, absolutely. It is adopted. And to me, it's, I was always pleased I've had an opportunity to work on it. You know, it was, you could see the demand was going to be there. You know, you're 100 miles for a truck from Norfolk to Richmond. Now, if you look at a map, Richmond sits on I-95. And that is probably the busiest interstate highway in all of the United States. And if you're located in Richmond, the market that you serve by truck almost makes it to New York. And as you go south, I think you can get to Charlotte. You would switch from I-95 to I-85, but that's the market Richmond distribution centers, warehouses can serve. Tremendous location. I'm surprised that it doesn't have five times as much industrial real estate, as it does have. I'm working with a couple of colleagues there when somebody's trying to sell a building, and I also get involved with real estate deals, especially when they're related to transportation. So that's how I know this.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. I want to switch.
Place where container barge works in the U.S., and that is from Seattle up to Alaska. So,
okay.
Some very long running, container and barge services coming out of there. So those are the only ones that I really know of. We had the one that we did, or I was involved with, but that was so short lived. But there are definitely container and barge services that work for the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And if we just switch the focus real quick upon the, or we turn the table to the customer side, obviously what you mentioned prior to the podcast, the three C's, meaning cost, capacity, and consistency, that's something I want to put up. And I also want to connect it with regards to Incoterms, as well as the ownership of the cargo, meaning how do you think those three topics, meaning Incoterms, three C's, and the ownership of the cargo have an impact on barge services, respectively, the way they are shipped, meaning truck versus rail versus barge?
Yeah, so I learned the three C's from Rick Gabrielson, and Rick worked at Target. It's a big U.S. retailer. And over a 25 or so year period, he built their global supply chain, even to the extent of helping China fix its customs. Because when you took a container from inland to the coast, to the port, as you crossed from one province to another, you also had a bit of a customs fee that you had to pay. And it slowed everything down. You should really just be able to put something on a truck and it goes nonstop over to a port like Ningbo, right, or Shanghai. So he received all the marine industry awards one year. Rick is a good friend of mine, and he's the one who banged the three C's into my head: cost, consistency, capacity.
Okay.
There is a fourth one that you can think about, but the reality is it doesn't matter. And that would be time. And so you have some products that have a fixed shelf life that, if you don't get the product delivered in time, it's not going to work. So an example of that would be food. You pick the bananas off the tree. You only have so many days before they're too rotten and you have to throw them out. So the more time the banana spends in transit between the tree and the store, the worse it is for the seller of the fruit. It's the same thing with the products that go stale very quickly. Like, for example, fashions. You always get the new fashion into the stores 6 weeks before the next season begins. And during that period, you can sell the fashion at a good price. And then for the next 6 weeks, as it gets ready to be put in the discount bins, the price starts to fall until you just fire sale it and to get it out of the store, because you need to open up space for the new season's merchandise. And so if the shipping time is too long and you don't hit the mark, then you lose a lot of revenue. So let's leave the time thing aside. Let's just focus on the cost consistency and capacity. So on the cost part, it's pretty obvious. You know, shippers, everything else the same, prefer a lower cost to a higher cost. And so, a container on barge in that sense can be very effective, because if you can do over 600 miles to, you know, on 1 gallon of diesel to move a ton. So cost-wise, it could be very, very cheap. In fact, I was looking at some website and they said 15 barges for moving bulk is equivalent to 1,050, very large semi-tractor trailer trucks.
Wow.
So we often compare moving things on these huge vessels, these 22,000 TEU container ships. And then you look at a barge, only it does 250 containers. And you think, wow, that's small. But yeah, but the cost of moving that is really, really low. And so in that sense, you are getting some kind of a scale economy, an energy scale economy. So the cost-wise, very effective. Consistency. Well, we started off talking about the Mississippi River. And so when you use rivers have one of three states. They're either at flood stage, they are at too low of a stage, or they are on average. And so depending on the geography, the river could create some capacity issues as well as consistency issues. But so that's, you know, kind of a way to think about it.
Makes absolutely sense, and especially given the whole sustainability topic, which becomes more and more important and popular, not just for a rather tiny fraction of BCOs, but more and more players within the whole economy are looking towards sustainability goals, reducing CO2 emissions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm with you. So the barges would not only make sense on cost-wise, if we take a look of it from a cost perspective, but also from the sustainability aspect, simply because it also produces by far less emissions than if you would truck the whole volume to from A to B, right?
Right. No, exactly. You were going to say? I mean, basically, the way to
think of this. Oh, Pat, I just wanted to say hello real quick to Pat, who's joining us from the Mobile Canvas Studios as well.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Finally found a place to park this beast so I could get on board. I've been listening otherwise, and it's always great stuff. The Richmond thing, yeah, we're definitely loving that. Definitely loving that. It's really showing how simple this really can be and how effective it can be.
Exactly.
And I miss your 53 thing down there on the Gulf Coast. It was really starting to kick into gear, and too bad the world changed our mind. I'd be curious to ask to that. Is with a domestic portion on that, if we were to able to keep those 53s going up the river, up into the central U.S., do you see that as having an effectiveness?
You know what, I do. I think I think you can make that work. In fact, there are some guys working on a connection between Plaquemine Parish and Cairo, Illinois. I think I pronounced that correctly. It's really you say Cairo, or everybody knows you don't know anything about that place. So it's sort of like the same thing with Mobile, right? You don't call it Mobile, it's Mobile.
Right.
You know, otherwise people look at you funny. So I have a lot of hope for something like that to actually work out. It's just that the trick has to be to, I would use 53s. If you want transloading to be done, do it down by the water where you can have land and service dedicated for that. But what could happen with the 53 is when you stop anywhere, is going up the Mississippi, just take the 53 off onto a truck and,
Right. Yeah, it would open an entirely new intermodal lane for domestic truckers.
Not only that, Pat. I mean, if we take a look upon what J.B. Hunt and also what's this other new barge service called? M53 or something like that. Or Charter 53, something around that. So it's in fact even a German company that set up a dedicated shipping line, so to speak, for containers from, I believe, Shanghai and Ningbo up to Oakland, Port Kuname, probably wrongly pronounced, down in Cali, and I think even up to Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. So there are, in fact, small players that identify such niche trade lanes. And obviously, just for the audience to make this clear, we're not talking about your regular 20,000 or 25,000 TU vessel, but much rather on a 200 TU, 300, 400 TU vessel, which then connect Asia to one or another US port or even inland port based upon a river, where I do think this could also make sense, or would also make sense, which is basically following what Walter described earlier with the Brownsville, Texas to Tampa, Florida connection, just on a little bit broader scale, right?
Right. Well, there is a Matson, an American company, and they do run small ships across the Pacific. They do Shanghai to LA, I think, in 11 days. It's the fastest direct service. Zim. The Israeli company, they also have one. They call it their e-commerce service, but they do it in 12 days.
Wow.
I would think sometimes the size of the vessel would add to the economy of scale, because you're moving things, you're handling them for less days.
Exactly. And you're right about that point. I mean, if you double the size of a vessel, you don't double its fuel consumption, everything else the same. So you get scale economies that way, that,
This would also lead me to another question here, which just described, Walter. I mean, what would be the impact if we're considering those economies that you just described? How would this also impact the capital velocity?
Well, I'm not sure. I saw you had brought that up before. I wasn't sure what you meant by that.
But if we're talking about velocity of capital, it's how soon or how much interest they actually don't have to pay, how quick their money turns and so on.
No, that's fine. You build these ships, the larger the ship you build, the more years it takes to amortize, the cost of building that. So we look at shipping costs to figure out what's a reasonable starting point before you add a profit margin on it. We do look at the 10-year amortization cost of the vessel.
Yeah. Now, on a customer side, if you were a shipper, using the Incoterms through the AMH, being that you can whichever particular Incoterm you use. When it crosses, let's say the one when it crosses onto the vessel, as soon as it crosses off of U.S. soil onto a vessel, you get paid. Things like that along the AMH, how could that add to a smaller company or larger company's velocity of capital?
Well, this is an interesting point that you make. There are American retailers generally do not take receipt of the inventory until they want to. So basically, it belongs to the shipper. So let's say I'm the American retail store, Walter Mart, and I'm importing stuff that's made in China. The stuff that comes from China, it can even hit the ground here, But until I say put it in my distribution center, I don't take ownership of it. And so basically you can keep your accounts, you know, your balance sheet, you know, pretty slim. And if you're a large enough retailer, things that you can do is, you know, you can postpone paying your bills for about a month. And meanwhile, as you collect cash from your customers, you cash in on the credit card payments within 2 days, and you end up with what's called negative working capital. So you don't have money tied up in the system. You've got the system with money tied up in you. And a lot of companies that do that make pretty good interest income off of their negative working capital. So put that money into the bank. So it varies. In other places, it's not possible to do that. You know, as soon as the product hits the U.S. soil, it's yours. And you pay for it right then and there. So there is a wide range of arrangements and financial structures that, you know, makes it, it's not such an easy question to, you know, to answer.
Mm-hmm. But it is possible to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let alone other possibilities like vendor managed inventories or vendor managed warehousing and free trade zones, etc., which would also help to postpone, let's say, your bills, or which would allow you to keep your working capital longer, right?
Yeah, that's correct. You can avoid having to pay out the money until the very last minute. The problem is you don't want to leave the stuff at the ports. The ports get very angry because we all know that well is the enemy of capacity. So right now the ports are very unhappy in the U.S. because the ocean carriers didn't take all the empties back to Asia. You know, those empty containers, they're a leading indicator. You know what they're telling us, because they're accumulating at the ports and not going on the ships. It's telling us that people in Asia aren't screaming for containers, which means people in Asia don't have a lot of orders for stuff to be made by them to send to the U.S. And that means the guys who normally order that stuff are anticipating much slower consumer spending in the next at least 6-7 months. So
that's a great point, here, Walter. And I also think that this is basically, you just gave the perfect explanation also why the container rates or the ocean freight rates dropped across the board, right? Simply because there is not enough demand for exports in, let's say, Asia, for example, right?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Anyways, but going back to your Incoterms point, the velocity of capital, one thing that is changing all of that is Bitcoin, with the existence of cryptocurrencies. We already have some parts of the world where some countries mine a whole bunch of bulk stuff, put it in bulk ships, and it goes to other countries that consume it. That product is pretty standard. The route is pretty standard. It's almost it almost operates like a pendulum. And so to get the banks out of their business, the companies have agreed to their own version of a cryptocurrency. And so that changes the terms, you know, that you would use, your Incoterms. I am not familiar with how that works. I just was reading about it in the Journal of Commerce's bulk magazine. So I thought, this is something I got to look up. But it's been 2 years now, and I still haven't.
Things get in the way.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I just wanted to bring that up, that the cryptocurrencies can play a pretty decent role here. And a lot of the people in the crypto space think that you could eliminate the need for letters of credit issued by banks. So you might remember going back to 2008, when the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, let the Lehman Brothers Bank fail, which is a horrible mistake, the banking system itself completely froze because they didn't want to pay out on anything. They didn't know if they were going to get the money they were owed. So everybody just went paralysis. You couldn't load anything onto ships. And you might remember we had automobiles parked up the kazoo at every port and containers all over the place. And we were still making stuff and sending it to the ports. but we could load it.
At the time that happened, I was working for a metals company, and we had 2 months worth of container freight on the water and a couple of bulk carriers. And basically the people on the other end said, keep it. And so they had to go over and negotiate a killer loss just to get it off the ships and sold.
Yeah, because the charter rates for a lot of for those ships were pretty bad. It was a seller's market for a lot of the product, not all of it. And but the worst part of it is how the sailors got treated. You know, that's tough. Yeah. COVID was tough on them as well. I mean, to be stuck out at sea for, you know, 6+ months is not easy.
And we tend to forget about that, it seems, you know, more often than not, whether it's the seafarers, whether it's the truckers, whether it's the port workers, terminal workers, whatever, oftentimes those crucial workforces are completely being overlooked and even at some point, maybe even disregarded.
Yeah, those are two charities where I give money to. One is for the seamen, and there's a global organization, Seamen's Chapels, around the world. So I support them. And then my other favorite one is, you can't see it right now, but it's Farm Rescue. And I give them, I think, a pretty good contribution. This is to cover the travel expenses, you know, lodging and food for retired farmers who, when another farmer who's working, you know, is unable to farm his farm, these guys jump in buses and planes and trains and rush over there to work the farm for the, you know, for the ill or incapacitated farmer. So
that's interesting.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, we have to remember that we depend on these people. It's so easy to forget, you know, and it's easy to get angry about labor union negotiations and work stoppages. I get all that. But we depend on these people. You know, they make, those guys make the food, the other guys haul the food.
Correct. It's literally the backbone.
Yes, it is.
I can tell you when COVID first kicked here in the U.S., I was out in my truck, and pretty much every state I drove in, all rest areas were closed. All truck stop buildings were closed except for fuel. I mean, you were literally living in your truck 24/7. That there was nowhere you could go.
I was on the governor's Council of Coronavirus Task Force. And we were just trying to find things that needed to be addressed immediately. The one that I had to keep pounding my table over, because being an economist, everybody views me as an economist, not as a transportation economist. So I had to keep pounding the table on it. And it was the lack of coordination between states on what was an essential industry. Drove us crazy. You have a truck load up in Georgia and then show up in Delaware, and Delaware it's closed because that warehouse is not part of an essential industry.
Right.
So the truck driver had to do what? Turn around, come back. I mean, it was. And did you experience any of that, Pat?
I got lucky. The stuff that they were looking for me, places were open. But the building materials they were using like crazy. I couldn't actually, at that point, I couldn't keep up with it till the pressure treated disappeared. Wow. What really happened with me mostly was the closed facilities for me to buy food. User restrooms and things like that. That was the most difficult part. Other than the fact that it was very weird to be driving along on the road all day long and be the only vehicle within sight. I've got a picture of I-95 just north of the Connecticut border, 4 mile marker, alone at 5:30 in the evening.
Oh my gosh! I used to work in Stamford up at the UBS building. You know, the one that looks like a ship a little bit.
Yep.
So, I know. That would be weird. In August, I drove up to New York, August 2020, helped my son move out of his apartment. He was moving to Bethesda. And so I had my little dog with me, and I had a Chevy Suburban, so we could really, you know, pack up with some valuables, you know. And I was coming along the Skyway in New Jersey, you know, on my way down to the Holland Tunnel. And I slowed down to like 5 miles an hour. I was the only person on the Skyway on a Sunday afternoon. Beautiful.
Isn't that crazy?
I could see everything from the Statue of Liberty as I drove all the way through to, you know, the Empire State Building. And it was weird.
It was quite eerie. It definitely was. It was spooky being out here in the beginning of it when there was just us drivers, just us trucks. But the interesting thing about that is they've always claimed that trucks are the slowdown, trucks are this or that. But during that first portion of COVID, truck transportation speeds actually gained something like in the order of 10 miles per hour nationally.
Yeah, and that stuck for a long time.
It was essential for everything.
Yeah, that's a huge amount of miles. It doesn't sound like much, 10 miles an hour. But on a national scale, when you're talking 3 million trucks on average, that's a lot of miles.
Well, 200 yards to my west here is I-95. 200 yards. And during the pandemic, when everything was shut down and it started to feel really spooky, the best thing is I'd walk out my door and I could hear the trucks moving on I-95. And you knew that. We weren't dead yet. How bad things looked. I used to go out there and I'd listen to the trucks and I always hated the sound, but boy, did I like it in 2020.
since we're approaching almost the hour, I want to ask you one last question two last questions, Walter, real quick. Circling back to the AMH, I would like you to explain to the audience what induced demand is and how it would affect also potential switch, maybe even the barges that you mentioned initially from Brownsville up to Tampa.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's impacting the U.S. a lot is a labor scarcity. You know, U.S. now has the lowest unemployment rate in probably 80 years. 3.5%. A normal unemployment rate's about 5%. And it's bad because if you don't have some slack in the economy, things that are trying to grow can't, right? It's the same thing for industrial real estate. The vacancy rate in the Savannah market here is 0.5%. So there's, a lot of people looking for a lot of millions of square feet of industrial real estate here, and there is no vacancy for that. It's a struggle to find things. So the advantage of a barge, as we were talking earlier, Pat, according to one website I was looking at, they said a 15 barge tow is equivalent to 1,050 large semi-tractor trailers. And so if you're having shortages of railroad drivers, truck drivers, being able to shift stuff onto a mode like container on barge is terrific. And, these days, every company that's publicly traded has a ESG mandate in their reporting, in their financial reporting. And so companies are actively trying to measure and monitor their greenhouse gas emissions. I met one professor at Ohio State who at a conference I was at. He presented data that showed that younger people are willing to pay for a cleaner environment. Everybody's always said they would like it, but nobody wanted to pay for it. But these days, the younger people who buy things, in fact, they prefer Goodwill to clothing stores.
By the way, we have 2 minutes left. Just
clothing. It doesn't have a carbon emission. And so what happens is the retailers are competing with this. And if they can't reduce their emissions, then they're going to have trouble selling. And so container and barge should be a very valuable offering for companies that want to, quote unquote, clean up their act.
Yeah, and the neat little side effect on that is a lot of it being intrastate transportation means we can load them all heavier. Roughly 20% more product in the same footprint of a move.
Yeah, exactly. Because we're limited to 80,000 pounds, right, on the interstate system.
Nationally, on an average, yes. Intrastate, we're allowed a lot more in most states.
Yeah, so on state highways. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. So ladies and gentlemen, we just finished the 1 hour mark. I gotta interrupt you guys, and I want to say thank you for everybody. Thank you, Walter, for taking your time being out here. Also, thanks to Pat for taking a break and jumping in. Highly appreciate it. Was a fantastic conversation again. I'm sure we're gonna have Walter back because He has a lot of information to share. Other than that, I'm wishing everybody a fantastic Halloween or fantastic day. And see you on the next episode. Thank you so much, Shadow. Appreciate it.
See ya.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
And thank you. You too. Take care. Bye bye.
Okay.